Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Rehabilitation Reimagined podcast. I'm your host, Nikki McCants, and this is episode 6. For this podcast was inspired by my work as a physical therapist in a neurologic-based rehabilitation clinic. Each and every day, I have the opportunity to use the expertise that I've gained through my training to guide my clients and their loved ones on a journey that can sometimes be fraught with uncertainty and emotions. Although I am a true believer that the work we do as PTs is incredibly important and essential, I have come to recognize that the best way to approach patient care is through a team approach. I've been faced many times with questions I don't yet know the answers to, or the realization that another type of specialist may be just what we need to burst through that plateau. I've witnessed how invaluable it is for the individuals I work with to feel supported and to meet others who have been through similar experiences. Because no matter how much compassion and empathy I bring to our interactions, I will never claim to truly understand what it is like to walk in a pair of shoes I've never even tried on before. So this project has an ambitious aim: to increase access to knowledge and information about rehabilitation and resources for optimizing quality of life for persons living with a neuromuscular and neurologic disorder or injury, to reach clinicians who want to learn more about the breadth of resources available to support the whole person that they're serving, and to provide a platform for storytelling and sharing as a way to remind each and every one of us that though we may not see ourselves in any or many of the people surrounding us, there's always someone out there who can relate. I'm excited to have you along on this journey as we cultivate and curate the content of this podcast and reach out to people around the country and the world who will hopefully find this information just when they need it the most. Hello, everyone. Welcome back. And if you're joining me for the first time, I'm excited to have you. So today's topic is one that I believe many of you will find relevant to your lives or to the lives of your patients, and today we're going to be talking all about driving. So we're going to be talking about returning to driving after experiencing some kind of injury or change in medical status. We're going to talk about adaptive driving strategies for those who aren't able to drive a standard car as it would come off the lot, for example. And also about the benefits of working with a driving rehab specialist who can not only perform specialized driving assessments in the clinic, but also behind the wheel assessments and training to help you get out onto the road safely. So our guest today is Leah Bertoni, occupational therapist and certified driver rehabilitation specialist. Leah graduated from Duquesne University in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania in 2011 with a degree in occupational therapy. And after working in more traditional OT settings for 4 years, she decided to pursue the specialty of driver rehabilitation. Leah joined Driving to Independence, a private practice in Tempe, Arizona, in October of 2015 and successfully achieved certification as a Certified Driver Rehabilitation Specialist, or CDRS, in August of 2017. Since joining the Driving to Independence team, Leah has been involved in various professional development activities. She's an active member of the Association of Driver Rehabilitation Specialists, or the ADED, and enjoys mentoring occupational therapy students and other therapists in the community on the role of driver rehabilitation. She has found a passion about the role of OT within the driver rehab field and the unique skills that an OT can provide to clients within this setting. She hopes to share a glimpse of that with you today. So our interview today will cover a wide variety of topics related to driving that I think both clinicians and anyone who may be looking to return to driving or to start driving for the first time will find helpful. If you want to find out more about Driving to Independence, a small private practice with locations in Tempe and Tucson, Arizona, and also in New Mexico, you can visit drivingtoindependence.com. For those of you outside of these areas, check out ADED.net to find out more about adaptive driving and resources local to your area. And finally, the American Occupational Therapy Association provides a ton of great information under their Driving and Community Mobility tab on their website, AOTA.org. And finally, you can check out the podcast website at rehabilitationreimagined.com for show notes and links to all these great resources. All right, let's get started. Hi, Leah. Welcome to the podcast. Thank you so much for coming on here tonight.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Yeah, you're welcome. So, you know, there's so much I would love to get to know more about you and how you got into driving rehab. And then I'd love to ask a few more questions about how we can apply this to our patient population and how clinicians can learn a little bit more about what to do when someone has a question about driving. So tell me a little bit, what inspired you to become an OT? And maybe you can even define OT, because I think a lot of people aren't completely sure what occupational therapists do in their scope of practice.
You're right. And I actually didn't know much about it until I started volunteering at the hospital a little bit as a teenager. So that's first how I discovered it. I knew I always wanted to go into the healthcare profession just because I always really liked helping people. So I did some exploring and volunteering at the hospital and ended up kind of finding it as a niche. I really liked that they helped people get back to being independent again, as well as just some of the creative aspects and holistic approaches that I think OTs bring. So that was my main interest. And then, you know, I went on to do the driver rehab specialty, and that was something I discovered just after being in the field for a few years. It was always a goal of many clients of mine to return to driving. And so that was something I decided to explore as I got more experience.
That's great. What did you find in your practice was, what kind of situations was driving coming up in terms of people maybe having questions about it, and what ended up piquing your interest from that?
So, you know, in college, I was always really interested in the environmental adaptation approaches to things. And I think that that's a big piece of driver rehab. In, you know, as I got experience, I, you know, worked in inpatient rehab for quite some time, worked with a lot of neuro populations like stroke and spinal cord injury, you know, and driving was a big part of just returning to their normal, their daily life activities, like getting back to work, getting back to getting groceries for themselves, getting back to school if that was, you know, a goal of theirs. So it just opened a lot of doors for them. And I think it was the transition from being independent in the home to now being able to go out in the community and be social and have that quality of life even further.
I'm really glad you mentioned that, because I think driving is something that most of us take for granted. If you're a regular driver, you know, you turn 16, you take a test, you get your driver's license, and you're kind of off and going. And you know, unless that has been taken away from you or threatened in some way, I think a lot of us don't necessarily reflect on how many doors driving opens up for us, and how when that's taken away, it really impacts so many aspects of your life. Like you mentioned, being able to get up and go somewhere when you want to go somewhere. If you have a job, being able to drive to your job, or if you're looking to take a position that involves driving around during the day, maybe to different facilities or traveling for work, all of a sudden that's taken away from you. And then certainly participating in social activities is something that's really impacted. And I know, at least from my experience in PT school, driving was not something that we talked about that much. And so I often find in my own clients, after they've had a stroke or they've been injured or had an illness and something has changed with them, they often ask, when can I get back to driving? And I find that I don't have enough information to be confident about that. And I'm sure you're going to address this, but from my perspective, driving is requires so much skill and so many different parts of the body working together. And the implications of getting on the road when you're not safe are so huge that it's kind of a scary thing, I think, as clinicians to want to give a yes to that when we're not really sure how to test for that and address it safely.
Yeah, I agree. You know, and that is why certified driver rehab specialists exist, because as you know, maybe the generalist therapist, there are risk factors that you may be able to look for. But again, there's so much weight in that. So if you're doing clinical assessments only, and you're relying on that information, and you say that someone is safe to drive, and then they go out and have an accident, it's then that liability perspective. And that's why the behind the wheel assessment is so important and so helpful. You know, we do in clinic assessments as well as behind the wheel assessments all in one. And so I've had multiple clients who have aced the in-clinic assessments and then do terrible on the road. Mm-hmm. And so those are the pieces that no one clinical assessment is going to tell us 100% how someone is going to do on the road. And that's where there's so much weight in that behind the wheel component.
Absolutely. So if we have any clinicians out there who are listening, what was the process like to become certified as a driving rehab specialist? What kind of extra training did you have? And how did that certification process come together?
So basically, I was in the field for a few years and then found this company, Driving to Independence, which was hiring for a driver rehab specialist. And so I thought, well, that sounds interesting. Let me do some shadowing and see if I like it. And so they did let me come in for a day and shadow with them. And I felt like it was a good fit. And so for about a year, I did training under a CDRS mentoring me and just, you know, got some expertise. And then once I had enough hours to sit for the certification exam, I was able to do that and then obtained my certification. So the certification is provided through ADED, which is the National Association for Driver Rehabilitation Specialists. And they have different requirements that amount of hours that you need to work in the field prior to sitting for the exam. So it just depends on your degree. For instance, with an OT, they require less hours than maybe someone who just has a general health professional degree, like a degree in kinesiology or physical therapy. I will say most of the time, you know, you'll see a lot of OTs who tend to be driver rehab specialists, but you certainly don't have to be an OT to do it. There's, like I said, kinesiologists, physical therapists, speech therapists who tend to go on to driver rehab training. So,
okay, got it. So it sounds like that's open to anyone who might have the background in, like you said, kind of some health-related profession and an interest in pursuing that mentorship and that advanced knowledge.
Yes, definitely.
Excellent. So we talked a little bit about the types of conditions that might present themselves as barriers to driving. So if someone had a stroke or they had a spinal cord injury, do you also work with clients who maybe didn't have a sudden change in their function, but maybe they've grown up with a developmental condition or cerebral palsy or something when that has occurred when they're younger, and so they haven't driven before, and this might be their first time trying to drive, and they're wondering, is it safe? Am I able? What kind of special modifications might I need?
Yes, we do see those clients quite a bit. And so, of course, they typically require a bit more training because they're novice drivers. So they're learning just the vehicle basics and basic rules of the road, but also if there's required adaptive equipment and things like that. So with the new drivers, we do what's called a potential to drive assessment. And that is basically looking at their potential through the in-clinic assessments as well as either an active passenger assessment if they don't yet have their permit or a behind-the-wheel assessment if they do have their permit. And those clients were looking at, like you said, the cerebral palsy. So it could be physical disabilities like spina bifida as well, or it could even be some of the cognitive disabilities like autism or ADD, ADHD, some learning disabilities. I think of those kids who may have needed a little bit of extra support in school, like maybe had an IEP, and now they're transitioning out of high school, and now it's what's next. Okay, they need to be able to drive to go to college or to get a job because they're not going to live with mom all for the rest of their lives. So I think it's really important for, you know, those clients to look into those services and really advocate for them, because we are out there to help those clients. And sometimes, you know, they get missed because they don't know about the services.
Yeah, that's an awesome service that you guys provide. Cause I can only imagine that there is that subset of, you know, young adults and teenagers that probably have the potential to drive, and maybe they're really excited about it and they really want to see if they can drive, but it may be stressful for parents thinking, okay, is this the right decision? Is this safe? How do I know if my child is going to be able to do this? And so having a resource where you can go to a professional who has these assessments that can really help them to figure out if there's some other things maybe that need to be addressed or worked on to help them to become a driver that's able to get a license, or if maybe it's not appropriate, but having someone to be able to make those I don't know if it's decisions. I'm sure we're going to talk about that later, but at least make recommendations as to what's appropriate would probably take a lot of stress off of them.
Definitely. Yeah. And there's different things that I think as having that medical background that we can help them succeed. Things where maybe a traditional driving school would not be able to provide that type of support or even understand the diagnosis to be able to adapt your training methods to those clients.
Right. So if somebody has had a, let's say, just as an example, you have someone who maybe just had a head injury, or they've been recovering from a head injury for a while, and they would really like to get back to driving. Family is maybe concerned, maybe the patient isn't really sure. So whose responsibility is it to report concerns about returning to driving? I know this might vary based on state, so maybe you can't give a perfect answer for everywhere, but if you go to the doctor and you say, I want to get back to driving, and there's something in your history that might be a red flag, does some kind of process get put into place after that?
Yes. And so you're right. It does vary state by state. So some states require the doctor to report after a medical change. However, others, such as Arizona, is a self-report state. And I will say that majority of our clients do not know that until they come to us and we tell them that. Mm-hmm. But what that means is that they are responsible as an individual that once they're medically stable enough to report themselves, they are supposed to report themselves to motor vehicle and go through a medical review process. And it's not a bad thing. You know, I tell people it's meant to cover you, because in the case of something happening, you at least would have something on file to be fully medically clear to return to driving. What that can mean is that they would potentially come through and do a full assessment, or it can just mean that their doctor is clearing them to drive, which would entail usually signing off on a medical motor vehicle form.
Okay.
So that's usually typically how the process works.
Okay. That makes sense. I know that I get asked that question a lot is, you know, is this going to get reported to my doctor? Is my license going to be taken away? And I knew that we were a self-report state here, but I was not completely clear on how that all worked and what that meant in terms of, kind of who would make the final decision. Okay.
Yeah. So, and I think it's good for everyone to look into what their state requirements are. Mm-hmm. It's like I said, it's a good thing to have it on file, whether you're medically cleared. So.
Yes, that makes a lot of sense, definitely from a safety and liability standpoint. So if someone does come in your door, either they are self-referring or they've been, can people self-refer to your business, or does it have to be through a physician?
So we always require a prescription from a physician.
Okay.
Because of just being an OT and being under some sort of medical process. And as well as once we get to the end of everything, we do have that medical form completed by their doctor. Okay. So having a doctor on file allows us to have someone to report it to and refer back to. But we have plenty of people who self-refer and then they get the referral mm-hmm. as we schedule them. So that's something we would walk them through as far as, you know, on the phone when they were scheduling.
Got it.
But yeah.
Okay, perfect. So once they do get to you, maybe you can tell us a little bit about the evaluation in more detail. I know you already mentioned that there was a behind the wheel assessment, and then there was also kind of a clinic-based assessment. So what does it look like when someone comes in? Kind of walk me through what I could expect.
Yeah. So typically we would start with just a basic intake, going through some medical history, medication review, just basic ADL status, like activities of daily living, how independent they are at home to gauge their function, as well as looking at some driving habits and routines, you know, what type of vehicle they drive, what type of areas do they typically drive in. And then we would proceed with the clinical assessments. So those parts are looking at cognitive function related to driving, their vision. So we do a vision screening to make sure that they meet the state requirements to drive, as well as some visual perceptual testing, physical testing, and then we would also do some just basic driver knowledge. So basic, you know, road signs and rules of the road. It's not anything we, you know, tell anyone that they necessarily have to study for. It's all stuff that general experienced drivers should know. Okay. And then we would proceed with the behind the wheel assessment. And so that, at least with us, so it differs kind of site by site between the different driver rehab offices. Mm-hmm. But in Arizona here, we have a standardized route because we're a third party for motor vehicle. So we have a set route, which we follow for everyone so that everyone gets the same behind the wheel assessment. And this allows us to just get some objective data as far as how their driving is. You know, as I mentioned earlier, the clinical assessment, it's not pass or fail. It just kind of gives us an idea of things we may see on the road. And there are things where I've had, like I said before, people who ace the clinical stuff and do terrible on the road, or vice versa. And so that's where that behind the wheel component is weighted heavily. But also considering their medical changes. So for instance, if someone maybe had dementia or something, they may drive great, but we're also looking at that cognitive piece. Can they maybe find their way around town, get from point A to point B, and make those independent decisions?
Okay. That makes a lot of sense. So I'd love to ask you a little bit more about some of the different areas of clinical assessment, because I think that would help either listeners to know if there might be something in their own medical history that could present as a challenge, or for clinicians kind of considering the question about, is driving appropriate or when should we refer for someone to get a driving assessment? But what do you look for in terms of the physical assessment? What are kind of the baseline skills that you'd like to see someone be able to do in order to drive safely? Maybe disregarding just for a moment the fact that you would be able to perhaps offer some adaptations to the driving.
Okay. Yep. So physically, you know, we're assessing their cervical range of motion, more so for checking, you know, mirrors and blind spots, as well as their upper body range of motion and strength for steering. And then their lower extremity function. Do they have enough strength and range of motion to access the pedals? Do they have enough coordination to transition from the gas to the brake, as well as that sensation piece? So that's a component that I think is often missed, you know, that maybe therapists are in the clinic are looking specifically at their strength, but they're not always testing their sensation. Right. And that sensation part is huge with driving, because we're not driving down the street looking at our feet. So, you know, we have to be able to rely on that sensation to tell us where the gas and the brake are, to tell us how much pressure to put on the gas and the brake. So from that physical aspect, those are the most important pieces. And again, like you said, I know with the adaptive equipment, but I will say that when there's a physical deficit, 99% of the time we can find an adaptation that will work around that. So just because you may have those deficits doesn't mean you're not a driver. There may be alternatives out there to make you safer long term, and that's something we would be looking at.
Yeah, that's really great to hear, because I work with a lot of patients who've had a stroke, for instance, that maybe have one arm that either they're not able to really use functionally at all, or it doesn't have the same kind of range of motion or coordination. And a lot of them are really concerned about being able to get back to driving. So it'll be great to find out what kinds of adaptive equipment are available to them. What about from the visual standpoint? What are some things that someone might present with that would maybe not be such a big deal, or other things that you would really be concerned about and be really looking carefully at when you get the behind the wheel assessment?
Well, so from a vision standpoint, we have to make sure that their acuity and their peripheral visual field would meet the state requirements. Okay. And that differs state by state. So that's something that would be have to be looked at based on whichever state each person is residing in. Mm-hmm. So, of course, that comes first and foremost. But there are other components that we are assessing in the clinic. So things like their depth perception, which can certainly impact how they do on the road, as well as their visual perceptual skills. So that's basically how your brain and your eyes are working together to perceive things. So on the road, we may see issues like lane position issues or misjudging how fast that car is coming when they're going to make a left turn at a light. Mm-hmm. So those are the pieces that can be missed with the just the basic general vision screening, but certainly things that can impact their safety on the road.
Yeah, okay. I definitely can see how those things would be very impactful. And like I said earlier, driving is such a complex kind of web of all these different systems coming together that you can see how one being off or a couple of them being impacted could really interfere with your ability to get around safely and perceive everything that's going on. And then I think you mentioned cognitive also as one of, or cognition as one of the other areas you look at. What are some of the cognitive concerns that you might be evaluating, something that might be impacting someone's ability to drive?
So, you know, cognition is basically just the general term. And then there's a lot of different pieces of cognition under it. Right. So related to driving, I would say, you know, executive function is a big part of driving. So that is basically your judgment and your decision-making. And so when you think about driving, you're thinking of, you know, pretty much deciding in every moment of driving. So it may be like deciding when to turn, deciding when to make a lane change, problem solving your route. Those are all pieces of that executive function, as well as the cognitive part. So like memory, for instance, that can be remembering your route to get from point A to point B, or remembering to put the vehicle in park. So that's, you know, that's what I've seen in the car. Sometimes people forget that piece. And of course, that's a big piece. You know, you go to park your car, and if you forget to shift into park, your car is going to go rolling down the road. So those parts can have a significant impact on someone's ability to drive. Unfortunately, you know, in some cases, there aren't ways to compensate for them. Mm-hmm. Such as in the case maybe of a dementia where things are progressing and you're not going to get that carryover. However, in other cases, like a traumatic brain injury, we may be able to remediate some of those skills or teach them different strategies to help make them safer longer term.
Great. Yeah, and I can imagine that there may be some referrals to other providers, or I don't know if you have a referral network that you use if maybe you see that there is an impairment that you think another professional might be able to support you in, if you guys ever refer out to other providers in the community.
Absolutely. Yeah, we often do. You know, we're of course doing those in-clinic assessments. And so when we see issues on the road that correlate with some of those clinical parts, and we feel like maybe there's room for improvement, we may be referring back to, you know, an OT or a speech therapist or even a physical therapist, sometimes even vision therapy or a neurooptometrist. Yeah. So those are the parts that I also think a CDRS brings to the table, because we have that medical background. So we know those referral resources and those solutions out there to be able to provide that information.
Okay, great. Yeah, that's really good to hear. It's nice to know that there's that interprofessional work going on, making sure everybody can support all the different areas that someone might need help in, because I'm sure that that's the best way to guarantee a successful outcome.
Yes, definitely. And that's what we all want is, of course, we want people to be independent, but we want them to be safe drivers too.
Yes, absolutely. So this question is going to be a little bit geared towards the clinician side, but some of the awesome OTs at my clinic were wondering if you could talk a little bit about some of the specific kind of named clinical assessments that you use. Are there any specific like cognitive screens that you use, or maybe fine motor or visual perceptual screens that you like to use that maybe OTs or other clinicians out there might be familiar with or maybe not familiar with?
Sure. So there are quite a few assessments who have standardized data to back up driving crash risk. So one of those is TRAILS, the trail making assessment. So TRAILS A and B, typically, you know, TRAILS B is looking at that cognitive flexibility and that executive function part of driving, which highly correlates with the crash risk. So that is a big one. The MoCA and the BCAT are some other cognitive screening tools that we use. The MVPT is one of the visual perceptual tests that we use, and that has, again, some data to back up with crash risk. Specifically, the visual closure piece, that one has been researched quite a bit in regards to driving. I would say that those are the main ones. And like I said, you know, we do some basic roadway knowledge and rules of the road to gauge their cognition level. You know, especially for experienced drivers, when they can't identify a stop sign in the clinic, you know, that's pretty telling as far as what their cognitive status may be. And then of course we do the basic vision screen to make sure they meet the state requirements to drive.
Makes sense. Absolutely. Thank you.
Yeah.
So if we move on for a second to the behind the wheel test, so what might that look like from if you've determined through your clinical assessment that it would be safe to proceed with the behind the wheel assessment? I know you mentioned that there's a standardized route that you take people through, but what does that look like? I can imagine just thinking about being the clinician kind of getting behind the wheel with people who were not sure yet how safe they are with driving. I'm sure that there are some precautions and things in place to make sure that as a clinician and as the kind of the client that everybody is safe, but tell me what that looks like.
Yeah, so we, again, like you said, have that standardized route. So it is meant to be progressive. So we start in a neighborhood setting, quiet neighborhood, and then it advances up as appropriate. So we would then advance up to some city streets and traffic lights and things, and then eventually into some higher traffic areas and possibly even the freeway if that's a goal for that client. So that is, we're looking at different things like the vehicle control, their decision-making at different intersections, their scanning. We have set skills that we're looking for. And of course, from that safety perspective, as you mentioned, so we do take it, you know, very seriously, of course, because it is such a high risk as far as the driving goes. We have a dual-controlled vehicle. If we have to intervene in any way, we have an instructor brake on our side to do that. And then if there are any concerns, of course, we would, you know, end the route if need be, and then come back to the office and discuss that.
Okay, great. And what happens if midway through, or perhaps earlier on in your subjective assessment or your clinical assessment, you determine that some kind of adaptation may be beneficial? Is that something that you can do day of, where you can implement that adaptation and then give the person a chance to try it out and problem solve that?
Yes. So in the case of adaptive equipment, we have all of our vehicles are equipped to install them just right there, and to switch out different equipment as needed. And that would be something where, of course, as you know, a new equipment user, we're not going to throw them into city traffic because it's their first day of experiencing that. So we would start in an empty parking lot and then potentially advance up into a quiet neighborhood if they were ready for that. But that's typically where we would start for someone who's maybe a brand new driver, or, you know, a new vision device user, or even just a new hand control or left foot accelerator, or any sort of adaptive equipment user.
Okay. And do you offer training, like if you determine that a particular adaptive device is appropriate for somebody, is there, beyond the assessment, does your company or maybe other driving kind of rehab companies offer training for that device before somebody maybe goes through the steps of purchasing that or getting funding for their own vehicle?
Yes, we do. And that's definitely something we would encourage because, you know, as someone who's brand new with equipment, we don't expect them to just go out and know how to use it. That's something where we want to make sure that they're safe to use it before we would want to prescribe getting it in their vehicle. And there's other things that we're looking for throughout their training. So, you know, there's different tweaks or adjustments that we may need to make to the equipment before getting it installed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. That's good to hear, because as you would say, or as you just said, something that's novel to someone or unfamiliar, especially if you've been driving previously and you're used to operating a car in a certain way. I think that maybe the longer you've been doing that, the more difficult it is to initially shift over to something else. So having the time to work with somebody who can advise you on that, make sure it's appropriate and make the necessary adjustments is a great option.
Yes, definitely.
Great. So, I have a few more questions about adaptive equipment, but before we move on to that, can you tell me a little bit more about what the potential outcomes are for these assessments? Like, is it pass fail? Is there a range of potential outcomes, and what is the result of those different outcomes?
So there's really a range of potential outcomes. One of those being that you're safe to get back to driving, and then we would just proceed with the medical review process. Another option may be that we're recommending adaptive equipment or some sort of, you know, low vision device like a prism lens or something like that. And then we would recommend behind the wheel training with that. Or it may be that we're recommending that you're not safe to drive right now, maybe pursue some other therapies and return in a certain amount of time. Or the last option may be that you're no longer safe to drive at all, and we recommend that the person retire from driving. So that one's never really the goal, of course, but there are times that it happens, especially with maybe progressive conditions where, you know, as I said earlier, we may not be getting that carryover or may not expect improvement.
Okay. All right. And I get asked this question a lot because I have recommended your facility and being local to Arizona as well into this area for some of my patients and clients to go and get assessments. But the thing they often ask is like, well, what if they determine it's not safe for me to drive? Is the, you know, motor vehicle department going to take my license away? So what happens if you do make the recommendation that perhaps it's not safe for them to drive, or maybe it's just not safe right now? Perhaps you've recommended some kind of remediation or that they need to take these other steps and then come back for another assessment later. What happens with their license at that point?
Yeah, so that is part of the, you know, part of the process is that we do report everything to motor vehicle. Mm-hmm. So that differs state by state and facility by facility, but that is part of our program. And so what would happen is that would get reported and then their license would temporarily get medically suspended. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean it's going to get revoked forever. It just means that once they're ready to resume driving or cleared to resume driving, we would have to fill out additional paperwork and then their license would get reinstated. So it's not like the end of the world that you're never going to drive again. Potentially it may be something where they just maybe need a few more months or a few more therapies to recover and then maybe resume driving down the road.
Okay. That's good to know. And it sounds like a piece of that may also be if you, once you refer back to the physician for the medical clearance, if you've made a recommendation that based on these things, it's not safe, that they would likely also not sign that medical clearance. Is that accurate?
Correct. I would say majority of the time, the physician is on board with our recommendation, mainly because we're the ones, you know, who get in the car with them. And so they trust that medical opinion. And also just if they were to sign off on that medical form, then, you know, it can be that liability aspect that I think a lot of doctors would be hesitant to take.
Right. Okay. So another question that I get asked often is whether insurance pays for these assessments. So maybe you can kind of answer that question and give a little bit more information about how the assessment itself is funded.
Yeah. So, you know, traditional medical insurance typically does not cover in-vehicle assessments or in-vehicle training or adaptive driving equipment, mainly because they don't see driving as a medical necessity. Mm-hmm. I wish they did cover it, but they don't. But there are some other alternatives out there. So I would say, you know, with our clients, vocational rehab tends to be a big resource. Mm-hmm. So that is basically a program which each state should have a program for that, but they might be called something different. And that's basically a program which helps someone with a medical change resume employment or work towards school-related goals, such as college, basically to have them be back into the employment world. And so driving is a big part of that, because a lot of limits or barriers to employment are the fact that people can't get to their job or get to interviews. You know, in Arizona here, the public transportation is not always the most reliable for someone who wants to work every day and be on time for their job. Yeah. And it's also the climate isn't feasible for someone who may be in a, you know, a power chair and they have to sit outside for an hour and wait for the bus. So those are pieces that driving helps with securing employment as well as maintaining employment. So that's one of the big resources. The VA is another resource. So if you're a veteran, I would recommend talk to the VA about their driving program and different resources that they can provide. And then workman's comp is another big resource we have. I will say, aside from those, majority of our clients are private pay. There are some other third-party funding, like the National MS Foundation, who may sometimes give a portion of cost towards an assessment or towards adaptive equipment, and there's some other grant-based programs. So it differs, you know, state by state, but that's something I would just recommend that someone call their local CDRS, and they can be able to walk you through some of the resources available in your area.
Got it. Okay. And so this is extending, as you mentioned, not only for the assessment itself, but the adaptive equipment outside of some of those like workman's comp or the VA or maybe vocational rehab. Someone would be independently responsible for funding their adaptive equipment unless there was some grant related to the condition that they have or something else, or, you know, another organization in the area that might be willing to fund it.
Correct. Yeah. Would be the case. If they don't have one of those funding resources, they would be privately paying for it. Mm-hmm. You know, and it's an investment. There's no doubt about it. But I always tell people, you know, you have to look at, is it this important to you? Is it worth that investment? Yeah. You know, of course, if it's going to help you be more independent or get to work, then it may be worth it. Yeah. And so, yeah, and the safety part of it too. You know, if it's something where it's going to make a big difference, that liability, is it worth putting yourself at risk for a potential lawsuit or, you know, accident or ticket, which may be more costly than the equipment itself, mm-hmm. and doing the process as you should.
Yeah, that is a good way to look at it. Although I do have to say, I wish that there was more funding out there through insurance or other measures for people to have the adaptive equipment, because not only do you have to have a car and find a vehicle and pay for that and the insurance and all those things, but then on top of it, you have the added costs of whatever modifications need to be made. And I'm assuming that some of those can be fairly costly, especially if you're talking about like a van that has a ramp that you can drive into and some of those bigger modifications.
Yes, definitely. I know they do get costly, and yeah, I wish that they did too. And hopefully one day, you know, insurance companies will turn around and start paying for some of this. Because I agree, it's important and it's costly. And there's a lot of people out there who, you know, don't go through these services because they can't afford it.
Right. Yeah. Oh, well, I guess we're just going to have to keep advocating for that. And hopefully one day we'll see a change there. But maybe you can talk a little bit more about the different types of adaptations that are out there. So at least in the patient population that I work with, some of the things that we're encountering are maybe someone who has a right-sided hemiparesis, a right-sided weakness, and now they really can't reliably use the gas and the pedal with their right foot. Or like I said, maybe they have one hand that they're not able to use, or people that have neuropathies that suddenly don't have very good sensation in their feet and they're not feeling the pedals as accurately as they used to, and that's a concern for them. And also maybe some of those, maybe spinal cord injury drivers or those with spina bifida that don't have maybe a lot or any function in their lower extremities. What are some of the different options out there that people could maybe turn to if they're able to?
Yeah. So there's a lot of different options. Some of the more common ones, of course, are hand controls. And so that's basically a device which attaches to the pedals, which allows you to accelerate and brake using the hand control. So that's you know, if someone has a spinal cord injury, for instance, or maybe even an amputee or neuropathy, that can be a good solution for them. For those clients who maybe have had a stroke or maybe cerebral palsy and they may have a hemiparesis, there are options such as a left foot accelerator, which basically allows them to use their left foot for the gas and the brake. There's one thing with that it, you know, it can be a little tricky for people to learn, especially as experienced drivers, because the gas pedal is now on the opposite side from what you're used to. So there usually is some training involved with that, of course, to make sure that they're safe with that device. And then as far as the steering goes, we have different steering devices. So there's a traditional spinner knob, but then they have all different kinds of grip devices that we can put on the steering wheel as well. So for someone who maybe has quadriplegia and maybe they don't have as much hand function, they make like tri-pin devices that can go into the wheel. And then there's a lot of other high-tech solutions as well. So for those clients who maybe have like a muscular dystrophy, we're thinking long-term. So, you know, we don't want to train them on, for instance, hand controls when 10 years down the road, they may have lost some muscle function and may require some other device. So usually we're thinking long-term, what's going to be the best equipment that's going to last them for a long amount of time, and conserve their energy as well and protect their joints. So there are some higher tech devices, like lower effort steering or joystick, which may allow someone to get back to driving.
That's so fascinating. I feel like there's a whole generation of young people coming up who play video games all the time who just probably be able to get into the car and just use those hand controls and those joysticks and get right after it.
I know. Some of these people, they pick up on it very quick. So
that's great. It sounds like there's probably way more out there than, you know, most of us are aware exists. But I really loved hearing you say that the vast majority of physical impairments that someone might present with can be overcome or remediated in some way with adaptive equipment. Because I think that probably gives a lot of people, you know, just relief to hear that and to know that there are options out there for them to hopefully get back to driving with the proper support.
Yes, absolutely. I can't tell you how many clients I've had who have said, you know, I was told I would never drive again, and they're driving. You know, and that's big. And that's a part of why I love my job, is because I am helping them to get that independence back.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm thinking too, and I think this is a question I've been asked before, you know, a family, let's say you have a family or, you know, a partnership, and one of the drivers needs some kind of adaptation. Is there, like, for instance, if someone has a hand controls or they have a left-sided accelerator, is it possible to switch that back to the traditional way of using it quickly if, let's say, you know, someone's spouse or their child or another, you know, caregiver is suddenly going to drive the car? Or are those kind of permanent changes to the car and now you would need to have a second car if another person was going to use it?
So the devices are installed, but they're not permanent as to where someone else can't drive. Okay. So like with the hand controls, the unit would stay there, but the pedals still work.
Okay.
So there, and now they even have some electronic hand controls where you actually just press a button and it turns the accelerator on or off, depending on if the person's driving in hand control mode or driving without hand controls.
Okay.
So there's not a second car needed. Of course, like I said, the hand control unit would stay there, but someone else can certainly drive it. And same with the left foot accelerator. So they make removable ones. So there would be a plate on the bottom of the car where the driver's seat is, where the left foot accelerator can just slide in and slide out. As well as they also make ones where they're electronic and they install them in the car. So there would be a pedal there all the time, just like on the left side of the brake. Mm-hmm. However, there's a button to turn it on or off. So it wouldn't be something that would prevent anyone else from driving with that vehicle. Okay. And of course, that's something we would educate the client on, how to, you know, turn it on or off or take it out of the vehicle, just to make sure there's no safety issues with that.
Yeah, that's good, because I can only imagine myself getting into a left sided accelerator and not
being like, what?
Imagine punching the accelerator, trying to punch the brake. And I'm like,
yes,
I'm sure there's a learning curve to all these things. So that's good to know.
Yeah.
And if somebody does, if you know, through consultation with a driver rehab specialist, decide that these certain types of equipment are appropriate and someone is able to fund it in whatever method they're able to do that, who kind of who orders that equipment? Where does it come from? And, you know, just as a general, how would someone go about getting those things into their car?
Yeah, so that is something, there's what's called a NMDA installer. So it's a certification, the National Mobility Dealer Association. And so their website is, you know, www.nmda.com. But they have installers all throughout the U.S. that would install that equipment. And so how that process would work is that we would write up a prescription that would go to the installer to state what equipment specifically they needed. And then we would work with the installer to fit everything and make sure that, you know, tweaks are made where they need it to be, wheelchair securements are done, placed where they need it to be. And then that would be, we would work together as a team and then meet at the final checkout and drive with the client to just make sure everything's good. And then we would do all the licensing stuff. So there are installers, you know, all throughout. We have, you know, quite a few in the Phoenix area. I think we have about 5 or 6 just right in the Phoenix metro area. Great. And so they're great resources as well. They will help to direct you in the right direction as far as what you need to do to get modifications. And there's things that they can help with too. So there may be someone, for instance, who maybe just needs a passenger modification. That's certainly someone who can go right to the installer and discuss with them the different options. They may need a ramp entry van. Maybe not someone where we would necessarily be involved because they're not a driver, mm-hmm. but certainly things that they can discuss and look at.
Okay, that's great to know, because I know that question comes up sometimes is those passenger modifications and being clear that they don't necessarily need to go through some kind of assessment process, but that there are people out there whose jobs and specialties are making those recommendations, ordering and installing those pieces of equipment. So that's perfect.
Yes.
Yeah. Oh, this has been so helpful. You have no idea. This has given me so much information. I think so many people are going to find this to be invaluable information. Have you, just kind of as a last question here, has your work in driver rehab and driving assessment, has this kind of changed your perspective on maybe how city roads are designed and just travel in general? Are there things that you have noticed with the population and the people that you're working with where there are things that maybe we take for granted as just standard in terms of how we design roads and things like that, that you feel might be barriers that could potentially be changed in the future to make the road safer for everybody and more accessible?
Yeah, you know, I do. There's, of course, driving day to day. You know, I see a lot of things. I do find that Arizona, I think that they do have pretty good roads altogether. And things are designed in a grid, which I think makes it easy to navigate compared to some other places may. One thing I find that is can be tricky for a lot of clients is construction, mm-hmm. because I think, you know, depending on who sets up the construction, they may put the cones, you know, a little into your lane or things like that. And so that can be a little bit more challenging. But there are pieces, you know, and of course, even turns. So, you know, down in Tempe, where our office is, we have a lot of college students and a lot of pedestrians and bicycle traffic. Yeah. And so there's often accidents, people getting hit in the crosswalk and things like that. And so I think about, okay, how can they make this safer? Clearly, you know, they're making a right at a green light, but they failed to yield to that bicyclist coming from behind them. Mm-hmm. Is there a solution as far as the traffic light, maybe having an arrow instead, mm-hmm. To help eliminate that issue?
Yeah, that's great. Those are, mm-hmm. and I'm not sure if there are methods for professionals like yourself to kind of communicate those things to the city, but I'm sure that's part of a much larger conversation around city planning and road design and things like that.
Yes, definitely. You know, and I will say too that with the city, I think a lot of education also comes with the police, with in regards to driving. We've had quite a few referrals from the police, who maybe pull someone over and they notice that maybe they've had some sort of medical condition that's impacting them, and then they refer them to medical review from there. And so I think that that's a good part as clinicians or CDRSs to also work with your local law enforcement to educate them on the potential option of a driving assessment, just to try to prevent those issues from happening. You know, we don't want to wait until someone has a ticket or an accident before we intervene. We want to try to get them safe or, you know, assess them before they get to that point.
Yeah, absolutely. That's really great. And that's something that I wouldn't have really thought about. But ultimately is, you know, benefiting the entire community to have and everybody on board with that plan and the police understanding what resources are out there that they can make referrals to, like you said before, you know, fixing a really big problem because something has happened instead kind of intervening earlier and hopefully creating a better outcome for everybody.
Yes, definitely.
Excellent. Well, is there anything else that you wanted to tell us about or share that I haven't asked you about yet that you feel is really important?
I don't think so. I can't think of anything specific.
Great. Well, as I mentioned in the introduction, you can find out more about Driving to Independence at their website, drivingtoindependence.com. And if you go back to the intro or take a look at our website, I've listed all of the websites that Leah mentioned that you can find some resources for driving rehab specialists in your area and also for the adaptive equipment and everything there. And I just want to thank you so much for your time. Like I said, I can think of so many people that I want to share this with. And if you're listening out there and you think someone might benefit from hearing this information, please feel free to share with them.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you so much. Have a good night.
You too.
All right, bye.